Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, New York Times, Rolling Stone, ClassicBands.com, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening is brought to us by a group you should be familiar with, the Eagles. This is entitled Last Good Time in Town, and it's from their 2007 release, Long Road Out of Eden. We'll be hearing more about and from the Eagles later on into today's program. But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us today from www.triviaplane.com. Question number one, what's the only rock group to claim two of the top 10 best-selling singles of the 1970s? Question number two, what studio did the Beatles use to record 191 songs? The answers to these two trivia questions will be given at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us by BGORecords.com, Today in Rock History. And today is June the 12th and June the 13th. What were the number one hits back in history on June the 12th? Well, back in 1965, you may remember it was the Supremes, Back in My Arms Again on June the 12th. And if you were born on June the 12th, you share a birthday with Reg Presley of the Troggs. He was born on that day back in 1943. Also Brad Delp of Boston, born on that day back in 1951. And also born in 1951 on June the 12th was Bunny Carlos, Cheap Trick. And finally, John Linnell, They Might Be Giants, was born on June the 12th, 1959. Jimmy Dorsey, the band leader, died on June the 12th back in 1957. Miscellanean rock history, well, back on June the 12th in 1965, it was the Beatles being awarded MBEs while filming Help. I don't think you got MBEs for playing rock and roll, said George Harrison. And back in 1972, sometime in New York City, LP released by John Lennon and Yoko Ono, featuring Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And back in 1982, Bruce Springsteen, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Gary, U.S. Bonds, and others played to 450,000 people at a rally for nuclear disarmament in Central Park, New York. 1989, on this day, June the 12th, the Elvis Presley Autoland Museum opens at Graceland. The museum contains over 20 cars, which were owned by Presley. What about June the 13th? Well, the number one hits back on June the 13th in 1970 was Mungo Jerry, In the Summertime. And 1970 also, the Beatles, The Long and Winding Road was the number one hit. And back in 1998, on June the 13th, Simply Red, Blue was the number one hit. If you were born on June the 13th, you share a birthday with Bobby Freeman. Do You Want to Dance? He was born on that day back in 1940. And Clyde McFadder of the Drifters died on that day, June the 13th in 1972. Back in 1958, Frank Zappa graduates from Antelope Valley High School. One of his school chums was Don Van Fleet, Captain Beefheart, on June the 13th. 1969, on June the 13th, Soul Bowl 69 takes place at Houston Astrodome with Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, and Staples Singers. And back in 1969, on June the 13th, Mick Taylor officially joins the Rolling Stones. Back in 1970, Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi hits the UK chart. Back in 1970 also, on this day, Bread debut on U.S. chart with Make It With You. Back in 1987, Motley Crue debut at number 5 on U.S. LP chart with Girls, Girls, Girls on this day, June 13th. And finally, on June 13th, 1989, Jerry Lee Lewis gets a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. This next article is from www.good.is. Is your favorite song a torture device? Posted by Morgan Clendaniel on October 22, 2009. A group of musicians today endorsed a Freedom of Information Act request to find out what songs were used in torture at Guantanamo Bay. There is ample evidence that the constant playing of loud music was used to break down prisoners. Detainees say that the music they most often described hearing was heavy metal, rap, and country. Specific songs mentioned include Queen's We Are the Champions and March of the Pigs by industrial rockers Nine Inch Nails. Another former prisoner, Binyam Mohammed, told Human Rights Watch that he had been forced to listen to the rapper Eminem's song The Real Slim Shady for 20 days. From this post, I've come across this list of some of the songs allegedly used: Enter Sandman by Metallica, Bodies by Drowning Pool, Shoot to Thrill by AC/DC, Hell's Bells by AC/DC, I Love You from the Barney and Friends children's TV show, Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, Babylon by David Gray, White America by Eminem, Sesame Street theme song from the children's TV show. Other bands and artists whose music has been frequently played at U.S. detention sites: Aerosmith, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Don McLean, Little Kim, Limp Bizkit, Meatloaf, Rage Against the Machine, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Tupac Shakur. Understandably, no artist wants to feel like their beautiful art can have the same effect as waterboarding. We'll see if the government actually releases these data. If they do, get ready for a bunch of tasteless torture mixes. In local rock news, we see this article entitled, Their Suspicious Package Was Overdue. And this article was written by Craig Lindsay, newsandobserver.com, on May the 7th, 2010. Earl Greyhound can't wait to come to the Triangle to perform, and for good reason. The parents of the band's guitarist, vocalist, Matt White, live in Chapel Hill. We usually think of Chapel Hill as Disneyland for adults, says bassist, keyboardist, vocalist, and Afroed beauty Kamara Thomas on the phone as the band traveled to another gig. It's like we get the home-cooked meals and, you know, we get to do our laundry in the house and, like, sleep in all day and watch cable like Disneyland. It seems that the Brooklyn-based Greyhound crew, White, 32, Thomas, 35, and drummer Rick Sheridan, 50, needs a vacation because they've been on the road touring and promoting their latest album, Suspicious Package, which was released last month. The journey to get Package off the ground and keeping it in the air is something that has taken most of the band's time for the past 3 years. It was certainly a trek to follow up their last album, the 2006 full-length debut, Soft Targets. Their previous drummer, Christopher Bear, quit after the album's release, with Sheridan joining the group a year later. Then the group was trying to get out of their record contract, mostly because the label, Sum Records, would soon be defunct. By the time it was time to go back into the studio to make the next record, says Thomas, 3 years had passed. Because things always take more time than you think they're going to take, including getting a record together. Package was actually ready a year and a half ago, but the band decided to get their business affairs in order, like launching their own label, Hawk Race Records, before releasing it. From the first time around, we realized how much catch-up we were playing, you know, she says, and that if we really wanted to, especially as in doing this all independently, capitalize on the opportunities that might come anyway, we really wanted to be prepared to go and probably be on the road for a long time, marketing themselves. You'd think more would have been said and written about Greyhound, a rock band whose multiracial makeup would seem fascinating and tailor-made for these Obama-rific times. Unfortunately, Greyhound remains one of the most on-the-fringe bands out there, baffling record execs who don't know how to market them. Still, they've managed to snag fans just fine on their own. What's interesting about that is that fans never have a problem accepting us, says Thomas. Like we never get any sort of questions about that from fans. The place where we found those kind of questions getting asked, or like those kinds of questions being concerns, were when we were getting pursued by major labels. And that, for us, was really kind of a really good gauge for us of why the music business was falling apart. It seems best that Greyhound stays on the indie tip, because their music, as evidenced by the all-over-the-place aesthetic of Package, makes them fall in a hard-to-categorize category. Our foundation is going to be kind of on the heavy rock side, she says, but we as songwriters and just as music lovers and listeners, our tastes go everywhere, just like the average music listener. And so we just kind of try to follow our instincts on what songs are coming out and being as honest as we possibly can about what we have right now. Staying busy. The group continues to branch out musically even when they're not together, skips down. However, when they get together, whether they're live or working on their next album, expect Earl Greyhound to unleash an intriguing mixture of sounds. I think you're always going to get a very eclectic album from Earl Greyhound, Thomas says. It's going to lean towards heaviness because we like to rock out. But in terms of our creativity, you know, that's always going to go in every direction that we can find it. So there's always going to be a bit of an eclectic thing happening, I suspect. This next article was published in the Boston Globe by James Reed, entitled Musicians Tap Fan Funding, published on the 15th of April, 2009. Ellis Paul, a veteran singer-songwriter who made his name in New England's folk clubs in the 1990s, found himself in a disconcerting position last year. He had decided not to renew his contract with Rounder Records, his longtime label, but wanted to make a new album. With no immediate idea for funding, Paul took up a novel approach. He enlisted his fans, posting a letter on his website asking for donations. Since July, the fans have surprised him by contributing more than $90,000 through a Farmingham, Massachusetts-based online service called Nimbit, along with checks sent in the mail. When you're only selling 20,000 or 30,000 records, you don't really need a label, he says. We figured we could do this in-house, but we just needed the money. And where was the money going to come from? In a trend reminiscent of the ways of artists and patrons, musicians around the country, including former Throwing Muses singer-guitarist Kristen Hirsch, are depending on their fans for financial support. Even as the record industry declines, indie artists are finding that their supporters are eager to help. In a sense, the fans are replacing the traditional role of a label, which previously would have financed the album and then taken care of the promotion and distribution. Piano-playing songwriter Seth Glier is only 20, but has already built a fan base that supported him on a recent month-long tour. Through online efforts, Glier raised $2,500. The initial goal was to raise only $500, which Glier accomplished within 2 hours. Services on sale. The fans aren't technically just giving money to these artists, they're buying services. To find the day after Everything Changed, his new album out in the fall, Paul allowed fans to buy different tiers of sponsorship, ranging from $100 to $10,000. The higher the contribution, the greater the goods. For $100, you got an advance copy of the album with a bonus disc of demos and outtakes, along with tickets to one of Paul's shows. For the top-level contributions, of which Paul received a few, fans got such goodies as a signed acoustic guitar or a credit as an executive producer on the album. Karen Zundel, a librarian in Pennsylvania who has been a devoted Ellis Paul fan for 12 years, says she even saved up for her contribution because it held more importance than your typical splurge. The arts are what sustain us and bring individuals and communities together and help us to connect with our innermost beings, Zandel says. A new car won't do that. But the way that art gets to the consumer is changing. Dave Cusack, Vice President of Berklee College of Music, who co-wrote the book, The Future of Music, Manifesto for the Digital Music Revolution, says the role of record labels is declining. I personally think unless you need massive radio airplay, there's very little reason for record labels to engage with artists anymore, he says. It's a relic of the past, in that artists today can find other ways to get to the market, to get money, to distribute their product in a way where they have a lot more control. Cusack acknowledges there are pitfalls to blazing a trail with fan funding, though. I do think there's some risk if you don't deliver, he says. Essentially, you are relying on people's trust in you. Jill Sobule, who rose to fame in the mid-1990s with the ubiquitous hit I Kissed a Girl, long before Katy Perry swiped the topic, recorded her new California Years with the help of $80,000 from fans after establishing a website specifically for the project. I know some people say that's a lot to record a record, she says, but it's also for everything a big label is supposed to do. Publicist, marketing, promotions, distribution. I've pretty much used all of it. It's definitely as humbling, she says, of asking fans for money. I feel like I better do the job for my fans. I better bow down to them more than a label. They're the ones in control now. This next article was published in Newsweek.com on the 28th of September, 2009, Magical History Tour by William Underhill. For the middle-aged pilgrim, the trail is well marked. Stroll west from Liverpool Central Railway Station and you're soon in the Beatles' quarter. There's the site of the Cavern Club, the sweaty dive where the Fab Four wowed their first British fans. For refreshment, try the Abbey Road Pub or the sleek Hard Day's Night Hotel with its submarine yellow jukebox and Beatles bus in the lobby. Or maybe head straight down to the Mersey waterfront for the Beatles story, the principal treasure houses of Beatles relics, housed in a smartly restored warehouse complete with a memento-filled Fab Four store. Want more? Even the ferry terminal gets in on the act with a four-dimensional Fab 4D show, as well as a new exhibition of previously unseen Lennon family memorabilia. If you squint hard on a clear night, you might even see a girl named Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Yeah, that one's a joke. But don't be surprised if some Beatlemaniac makes it happen someday. After all, just about every other Beatles dream is coming true. Devotees from the 60s are lining up for the remastered CDs. The BBC has run a series of new documentaries. And let's not forget the Beatles rock band, the video game that forces baby boomers to finally answer the 40-year-old question, if you had your choice, who would you be, John or Paul? But the lads' hometown was busy long ago enshrining their musical legacy with a rich mix of sentiment and commercial savvy. Every year, a few hundred thousand tourists are shepherded around the Beatles' sites large and small. The cathedral, where Paul McCartney was rejected as a chorister, the hall where the teenage John Lennon first met McCartney, suburban Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields. The city calendar now features a week-long Beatles festival, and since last year, a Beatles Day, July 10th, the anniversary of the band's return to Liverpool after their first U.S. tour. Trouble is, there's plenty a returning Beatle might not recognize now. Sure, there are still plenty of handsome monuments to the city's heyday in the 19th century when Liverpool was the greatest port of the British Empire after London. But for better or worse, this is no longer the raunchy city of the 1960s, still recovering from a wartime pounding by German bombers that shaped the Beatles. On a fine autumn day, the banks of the Mersey in downtown Liverpool make a great place for the coffee-swilling tourists, but the river is empty of shipping. Large patches of slummy inner-city housing survive, but much is gone. These days, Liverpool takes pride in the size of its shiny new downtown shopping mall and a cluster of new museums and galleries, including the new International Slavery Museum and the Tate Gallery's Liverpool Outpost. Last year, the city was chosen as Europe's Capital of Culture, a designation awarded annually by the European Union. In the past 5 years, the number of overseas visitors has more than doubled. The irony is that some of this would not be here if the Beatles hadn't put their hometown on the map. They are, in a sense, complicit in erasing the Liverpool that inspired them. Boomer tourists are thrilled that Lennon and McCartney's childhood homes are now in the hands of the National Trust, painstakingly restored to mid-20th century dowdiness. Though Ringo's modest first home in a working-class district is due for demolition, poor Ringo never gets any respect. Developers demolished the original Cavern Club in 1982. It survives as a brick-for-brick reconstruction, but it's hard not to wonder if the Fab Four would be happy about the ersatz legacy they've left behind, or if they'd rather that Liverpoolians long ago said, "Let it be." So, what do you know about this featured artist today? The Eagles. Well, this bio was written by William Ruhlman for the All Music Guide 2007, published on www.vh1.com. With 5 number one singles, 14 top 40 hits, and 4 number one albums, the Eagles were among the most successful recording artists of the 1970s. At the end of the 20th century, two of those albums, their greatest hits, 1971 through 1975, and Hotel California, ranked among the 10 best-selling albums ever, and the popularity of 2007's Long Road Out of Eden, a track from which opened today's program, by the way, proved the Eagles' staying power in the new millennium. Though most of its members came from outside California, the group was closely identified with a country and folk tinge sound that initially found favor in Los Angeles during the late 1960s as championed by such bands as the Flying Burrito Brothers and Poco, both of which contributed members to the Eagles. But the band also drew upon traditional rock and roll styles and, in their later work, helped define the broadly popular rock sound that became known as classic rock. As a result, the Eagles achieved a perennial appeal among generations of music fans who continued to buy their records many years after they had split up, which helped inspire the Eagles' reunion in the mid-1990s. The band was formed by 4 Los Angeles-based musicians who had migrated to the West Coast from other parts of the country. Singer-bassist Randy Meisner, born in Scottsbluff, New England, moved to L.A. in 1964. He became a founding member of Poco in 1968, but left the band prior to the release of its debut album in order to join the Stone Canyon Band, the backup group for Rick Nelson. Meanwhile, singer-guitarist, banjoist, mandolinist Bernie Leadon, born in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1947, arrived in L.A. in 1967 as a member of the Flying Burrito Brothers. Singer-drummer Don Henley, born in Gilmer, Texas in 1947, moved to L.A. in June of 1970 with his band Shiloh, which made one self-titled album for Amos Records before breaking up. Finally, Glenn Frey, born in Detroit, Michigan, in 1948, performed in his hometown and served as a backup musician for Bob Seger before moving to L.A. in the summer of 1968. One reason we're featuring the Eagles today as our featured artists is because they're going to be in concert here at the RBC Center in Raleigh on this coming Thursday, June the 17th, at 8 p.m. So let's listen to some snippets from the Eagles. We open then with Take It Easy.
Well, I'm running down the road trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on my mind. 4 that want to own me, 2 that want to stone me, 1 says she's a friend of mine. Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
And now we'll listen to a snippet from Lying Eyes.
Take it easy.
And now we'll listen to a snippet from Best of My Love. We'll close out today's program with Desperado. But first, this review of Jacob Dylan's new album, Women and Country. On Dylan's second solo CD, his palette ranges from the elegantly shuffling Lend a Hand to the lighter, catchier Everybody's Hurting, one of many tracks to boast backing vocals from Nico Case and Kelly Hogan. Producer T-Bone Burnett, who could probably turn a Miley Cyrus ringtone into a slice of melancholic Americana, gives the collection a predictably rich frame. It's given a B by Clark Collis, and he says, download these. Brass-assisted, Lend a Hand, spare, Springsteen-esque, Yonder Come the Blues. This was published in Entertainment Weekly on the 9th of April, 2010. So, how'd you do on the trivia questions? First question was, what was the only group to claim two of the top 10 best-selling singles of the entire 1970s? The answer was, the Bee Gees. And what studio did the Beatles use to record 191 songs? That was, of course, Abbey Road.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until...
She'll beat you if she's able. You know the Queen of Hearts is always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting no young. Your pain and your hunger, they're driving you home. And freedom, oh, freedom, well, that's just some people talking. Your prison is walking through this world all alone.
Next time.
Don't you forget.